When we find organizations who say, our company's just not like it used to be, it's either because they didn't really define who they were, or they didn't have a deliberate hiring process to make sure that the candidates mapped onto that. Those are two good ways to lose control over who you are as a company.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fellow, a software platform that helps managers and their teams collaborate on meeting agendas, track action items, and turn chaotic meetings into productive work sessions. Check it out at www.fellow.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fellow.app. Welcome to episode 70 of the Super Managers Podcast. This is a special episode. I'm so excited that we finally had Colin Breyer. He was previously known as Jeff Bezos' right-hand man during his time as a vice president at Amazon. Colin joined Amazon in 1998 and played a key role in developing the principles and processes that have made Amazon successful to this day. Today, we talk about a book that he wrote. It's called Working Backwards, Inside Stories and Secrets from Amazon. He wrote this with his co-author, Bill. And Colin and I basically dive deep into so many of the different concepts in this book. I've actually read this book twice, just to let you know how big of a fan I am. And, you know, a lot of my friends have bought this book for literally their entire executive teams. So excited to talk about concepts like the bar raiser process for hiring, leadership principles and organizational values. We talk about the whole narrative process on making decisions and how Amazon famously got rid of their PowerPoint presentations. We talked about how to create clarity of thought. We also talked about, you know, at Colin's level at Amazon, once Amazon was a really big company, the types of meetings and processes that he had as a leader and what his day looked like. And I probed him about so many of the insights and lessons that he's had during his time. This conversation was a true delight for me. I really hope you enjoy it, hearing it as much as I enjoyed having it. And without further ado, here's Colin Breyer on episode 70 of the Super Managers Podcast. Colin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
When I first reached out, I had mentioned that I had read the book twice. And when I say read, it usually means I audibled it. And, you know, just in getting prepared for the discussion, I kind of power listened to a bunch of the sections all over again. So I'm very excited to actually get a chance to chat with you. The thing that I wanted to call out is you and Bill obviously, you know, wrote this book, longtime employees at Amazon. How many people worked at Amazon when you first started working there?
When I started to work at Amazon, it was March of 1998, and we had about 100 people in the corporate area of Amazon, and then 400 people additionally. And we had two fulfillment centers at this time, and then customer service. So about 500 total, and then 100 in the corporate area. Product development team was small enough to where we could have the whole team cram into one medium-sized conference room. We'd be sitting around the table and then around the edges of the walls there too. But it was a little bit cozy, but we could all get together and talk about what we wanted to do and build next.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And then obviously, I think today Amazon has well over a million employees. something like that, right?
Yep. Yep. I think it's 1.3 and counting. So last time I looked, a little bit more than when we started.
Yeah. So this is super interesting. I mean, building a company like that and keeping it a well-functioning machine is not easy. And so you talk a lot about various principles and also frameworks. And so we're going to dive into a bunch of those. But I wanted to ask you, so obviously, you know, when you first started working there and as you started to grow, and even before that, you obviously held leadership roles at other companies as well. So one thing that we like to do on the Super Managers podcast is ask you, when you first started managing and leading teams, you might have made some mistakes or errors, and wondering if there's anything specifically that you'd like to call out, something that you did in the early days and later on through practice and learning, maybe you did less of.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was probably I'm dating myself, but, you know, mid-90s when I started to manage people. And, you know, one mistake I made was not realizing when the best solution to a problem was to hire your way out of that problem, where you just didn't have enough people. And so you kept trying harder or doing more yourself or asking your team to do more. And, you know, there are only 168 hours in the week and you need to do other things and work than work in that time. And so those hours. So really hiring often is the best solution, but it's hard to set aside the time and effort to go find the right candidates to join the team. But ultimately that is the only thing that will get you the bandwidth in order to solve those problems. I just say that's one mistake I made early on. And now I'm cognizant of when that is the solution and to put the effort in. And then a second one is it's not about you as a manager or leader. It's about the people that you're leading. And so just keeping in mind that as a leader or manager, your goal is to help make your team collectively do more than it could otherwise. And so you need to figure out what those things are, what the obstacles are, or what help you need to provide. And it took me a little while to, you know, to understand that and to really go out and seek what those obstacles are and then try to figure out how to remove them. So those would be two mistakes I personally made and how I incorporated that into my career moving forward.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I want to dig in on the hire your way out of the problem. How do you make that decision? And assuming that there's no constraints, it is kind of hard to figure out, you know, when is this within our capability, or like, when do we actually need to find expertise to solve this problem? Are there any kind of rules of thumb or things that you look for in order to make that kind of a decision?
Well, I mean, one indicator is if you're always prioritizing and reprioritizing because you know, there's so much that you want to get done, but you can only handle a limited part of that. And then when you look at the list of the things that didn't make the cut, that while we really should be doing these types of things, you know, that's an obvious indicator that if you had more people or resources, you could actually accomplish more as a group or as an organization. I think that's one thing. And I've seen this more with, you know, first time or relatively new managers, is their open headcount, that, you know, the TBH is to be hired. They sit on that spreadsheet for weeks and months and quarters. And that's when you realize the team is just, it's so busy working on the now and, you know, fighting fires that you're not really devoting the time to to build and grow the team. So those would be two indicators of when that happens. And when you have your annual planning process, or even, you know, sometimes it's quarterly, just be open and honest and look to and ask yourself, if we could invest in these other activities, would we? And what would those be? And, you know, would I spend my own money on this if I were looking at it as an investment? And if the answer is yes, then you move forward quickly, because you'll get to that outcome a lot quicker.
Yeah. And so I guess one of the related question is, say that there is a, you know, business that you're trying to get into or a problem that you're trying to solve. You may have the bandwidth to work on it, but for whatever reason, you're not making progress. And then, you know, part of it is that there's many potential answers to this. Either it's an unsolvable problem, either you don't have the right team, you know, you just need to keep trying. So in those more nuanced situations, how do you figure out that, like, maybe there's expertise that you can bring in someone and they can unlock this problem in a way that maybe your current team can't?
Well, usually when I've seen the case where there's a team, maybe not a team, but a set of people working on an issue and not making traction, a lot of times it's that the problem itself isn't completely defined. And, you know, Amazon has some practices, you know, which we may get into later about the working backwards process, which that's an iterative process. And really the first thing you do is you ask yourself, what is the customer problem or the set of customer problems I'm trying to solve? And, you know, it sounds very easy, but especially when you're pioneering in a new area, it's quite difficult. And, you know, use example with web services, you know, the term cloud computing didn't even exist at this point, but we were looking at the web services technology and figuring and knew that there was something there, but didn't really know what the right product to build was. And we didn't focus on what's the product we should build. We focused on what are real problems that are facing software developers today inside our own organization and outside of Amazon. And how can we build a product that solves those problems? EC2, that it started off as we wanted to help teams provision hardware so they could build and deploy services on the web. And as we peeled off the layers of the onion to really get to what the core of that problem was, it turned out it wasn't provisioning really. We were selling compute power and compute cycles. And the light bulb clicked on when, you know, someone wrote, and I don't know who it was, but they get a ton of credit for it, that we wanted to provide people in a college dorm room, you know, software developer in a college dorm room, the same access to world-class compute infrastructure as someone working at an Amazon and Microsoft and Google and IBM. And that the light really went on. Then that told us, okay, here's what we need to do. And there were some unsolved problems and we had to go tackle on how to do that. And that you begin to realize then what's the expertise we need to have that we don't have on staff. And, you know, do you partner with someone or do you go the long path and hire and acquire that resource, those types of skills on your own? But I think once you really understand the problem and what the challenges to solving that problem are, then it becomes much clearer on how to go do that.
Yeah, I think that's super smart. It's a lot of times it's the problem definition. I'll ask you more about the working backwards and the PR FAQ. Talking about hiring the expertise. So say that you decide that you are going to hire the expertise. You know, hiring is always challenging. But particularly as you start to scale, I know in the book you were talking about how you had new people who hired new people who hired new people, and you really wanted to keep the standard of hiring, and you wanted to keep the bar high. So you created this process called the bar raiser process. Would love for you to elaborate at a high level. What is that?
Yeah, so it's one of Amazon's first scalable, repeatable processes that I think allowed it to transition from this, you know, relatively small 100-person corporate company into a fast-growing, you know, large multi-billion-dollar corporation. But at its heart, it has a couple of components. One is it uses behavioral interviewing, which you know, asks questions about past behavior on how candidates exhibited and embodied Amazon leadership principles to predict future performance. That we found that was a better way to do it than brain teasers, and it removed some bias too, in terms of, you know, confirmation bias. The second part is the interviewing process. It's a data-driven exercise where each of the interviewers are assigned a set of Amazon leadership principles to go vet a candidate. And they have a specific job going into the interview. By definition, they don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle to understand, you know, to make a comprehensive hire, no hire decision, but they need to go in and get data for a subset of information about that candidate. And then it all comes together at the debrief where you put those pieces of the puzzle together. You've already submitted your feedback. You can't tell anyone else about your interview. Hey, this person's great. Can you just do a cell interview? You don't really want that bias to creep in because everyone is trying to get their own information You write it down, you make your vote, and then in the debrief, you put this information together and you read it holistically, where you get, that's the first time you get a whole holistic picture of the candidate. And at that point, it's okay to change your vote because now you've seen all the information. And then the other part about the hiring process is there, it's called the bar raiser process, but there's also a specific role called the bar raiser. The bar raiser is not in the chain of command for the, you know, it doesn't report to the hiring manager. So it's an independent role. And their job really is to ensure that the candidate, if they hire them, it raises the bar at, you know, at Amazon. It makes you know, Amazon overall, the talent pool quality increased. And so they don't have urgency bias or, you know, to hire the candidate because we need three people or we're not going to hit our goals. What they do is they're trained interviewers and they're supposed to help the hiring team make the right decision. They do have veto power, although in practice that's rarely used, because a great bar raiser will, you know, in that debrief will collectively guide the debrief panel to make a hiring decision. So it's you know, for new managers or it's new to Amazon, it's uncomfortable to say, I don't get a choice whether I want to hire this person or not. Someone else can trump my decision. But you realize that having everyone come in with different sets of information and having an independent trained expert to help the whole group make the right hiring decision, it just ensures consistency across the company. And it's a, you know, it's a lightweight process and it's scalable and repeatable and has a good feedback loop. Those debrief meetings are a great time to learn more about becoming a better interviewer.
Yeah, I have so many questions about this. First of all, I love the process because I assume that the original bar raiser was Jeff himself. And then, you know, the question is, how do you continue to scale that as time goes on? My question is, like, talking about the leadership principles and getting each and every person to be responsible for teasing behavioral situations for each one of those, however many they get assigned. Are there then, this is very tactical, but are there then a series of, you know, questions or like a question bank that you start using and everybody can kind of pick and choose from those? Or do you leave it up to each person to decide? How does that part work?
There is a knowledge base and, you know, question bank that you can use or get inspiration from. You know, when you're first starting to interview, you undergo interview training and you sit in on an interview, you know, you're paired with an experienced interviewer. The great thing about it is you can be trained to be a great interviewer, but it's not always intuitive. So you need some guidance along the way. It's a teachable skill, which is fantastic. Like when I go into an interview, I already have my list of questions that I'm going to ask. Sometimes I go off script depending on the answers that I hear, but I know that I've got to get this information and I need to write my feedback and defend it, the feedback in front of my peers. So I know I have a very specific job I need to get done and I need to make sure that that comes out in the interview. And as you do it over and over again, you learn tips and tools and you add to this knowledge base of questions or you ask, well, how did you get that information out of this candidate? I couldn't do that. And then you just, you know, that's where that feedback loop comes in. So those are a couple of tips. You know, go into the interview knowing what you need to come out of the interview with and have a plan of action on how you're going to get that information rather than just, you know, some people I've seen come into interviews at companies, they're looking at the resume for the first time and, oh, well, tell me about your resume. And they're not even listening to the answer. They're thinking about, well, what questions can I ask this candidate? You know, that you can save some time, everyone some time by putting a little bit of effort in up front about knowing what your goal and you know, is to achieve during the interview.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So people then do the ranking, they write the written feedback, they don't talk to each other beforehand so that you don't have a groupthink situation. And then during the debrief, this is not like the ultimate decision maker is still the hiring manager, except if the bar raiser obviously raises an exception, right? But it's not like a decision by committee.
Yeah, the interviewing panel is there to help the hiring manager make a great hiring decision. So yeah, the hiring manager will ultimately decide, yeah, am I going to hire this person? You know, assuming there's no veto again, which rarely happens. But yeah, so it's not, it is ultimately up to the hiring manager. And then it's up to the hiring manager, by the way, to go close the candidate too. It's not, let's push this person over to HR, because the people join companies really because of the team they're going to work with and the manager that they're going to work with. That's also the reason why a lot of people leave the company too, is the relationship with their manager. So you want to, from that first day, you want to establish a great relationship with the candidate and make sure that they're on board.
Hey there, before moving to the next part of the interview, quick interjection to tell you about one of the internet's best kept secrets, the Manager TLDR newsletter. So every 2 weeks, we read the best content out there, the greatest articles, the advice, the case studies, whatever the latest and greatest is, we summarize it and we send it to your inbox. We know you don't have the time to read everything, but because we're doing the work, we'll summarize it and send it to your inbox once every 2 weeks. And the best news, it's completely free. So go on over to fellow.app/newsletter and sign up today. And with that said, let's go back to the interview. So one of the things that, like, you know, the name BarRaiser is so apt because it's, you know, just the name of the process kind of reinforces this concept of trying to hire people that are at least in some way better than the average of what the team, you know, currently has. So what are some of the things that the BarRaiser can do, or some of the questions that maybe they can ask to make sure that that's the case? You know, obviously, you know, running the process is very important. And if you do all these things, you'll end up with a better hiring decision regardless. But are there specific things, like, for example, do you specifically ask, how is this person better than in some way than whoever else we have on the team?
One of the things when you're going into an interview is just finding out what that candidate specifically did in different instances versus, you know, so, and it's just, you know, by nature, some people like to talk about, I worked on a project and it saved the company $50 million over the year. But, you know, really understanding what was their role on the project, would that project have happened without them? So, you know, one question I'll often ask is, well, if we removed you from the equation of what you worked on, what wouldn't have gotten done? And, you know, sometimes it's, well, I generated reports for the group, or, well, you know, and sometimes people say it humbly too, like, well, it wouldn't have started because it was my idea and I just kind of shepherded the whole thing through. You tease out what was their specific role. And then the second thing that, you know, we look for is, you know, no one, Amazon has 14 leadership principles. No one's perfect at all 14 of them. No one. But just to find out, you want to, though, find out along, there's some dimension which they're a superstar, and you want to really find out what that is. And if that dimension happens to really help the group or the company or the team, you know, that is where you can raise, that person can raise the bar. So understanding where they are off the charts, you know, on certain areas, knowing that, trying to figure that out during the interview process helps.
That makes a lot of sense. And so, and then if it is a job of a technical nature, that happens, there's probably like a separate process for that, or a test of some sort, you know, other ways of evaluating skill. This is past the, you know, the person has the skills. Now we're trying to figure out if they're a good fit for Amazon.
Yeah, the functional skills, especially for things like software engineers, you know, data scientists, lawyers, you know, those are certainly important. And it's just, you know, each company can have a different way to vet those. So that is important. We just cover the really mapping it to the leadership principles, because what you want, especially for a young organization, you want to bring on people who are going to reinforce your culture or leadership principles, and you want to be deliberate about that. Because if you're not deliberate about that, they're going to have their own principles or cultures that they're going to abide by. And if you're an organization that's growing from 10 to 30, let's say, over the year, you know, at the end of that year, you're going to have a different company, because the, you know, the 20 new people who came in are just going to be doing typically what they did at their old company. And so when we find organizations who say, well, you know, our company's just not like it used to be, it's either because they didn't really define who they were with a very codified set of leadership principles, that this is what's unique about us as an organization, or they didn't have a deliberate hiring process to make sure that the candidates mapped onto that. Those are two good ways to lose control over who you are as a company.
So your leadership principles are also not, these are your, you know, other people might call these their company values. It's not, it applies to everyone in the company.
Yeah, everyone's a leader. And yeah, you companies call them core values, leadership principles, those are interchangeable. But it really defines who you are and then how you want employees at your company or in your group to make tough decisions very quickly when they don't have all the information they need and you're not in the room. So you want to make sure they have something to fall back on. And it's the same set of first principles to make that decision. And that's, I think, another reason why Amazon has had remarkably consistent types of decisions and behavior across a wide variety of businesses is because they all are falling on the back on those 14 leadership principles to make the tough calls, you know, when Jeff Bezos is not in the room or when the senior leaders aren't in the room.
Got it. And so the bar raiser helps you bring the people into the organization. Is there any sort of involvement, afterwards, months afterwards or years afterwards, or the official role of the bar raiser stops at the hiring?
The bar raiser, it's just for the hire, just for hiring. But what doesn't stop is those 14 leadership principles, they're really woven into every important process that the company does. And those processes were built from the ground up, with those principles in mind. So that part never stops. But the bar raiser process, it's a hiring process.
I mean, we talked about this a little bit in the debrief. It sounds like there's a written report. Everybody's writing, feedback in, and I assume the feedback is mostly in narrative format. I know that you at Amazon have been famous for getting rid of PowerPoints and shifting over to narratives, and specifically like culminating in this six-pager format. I'd love for you to describe, some of the key highlights of like why ditch a PowerPoint and like why a narrative is better. And then I have some specific questions too.
Narratives are a better tool for decision-making. We'll still use PowerPoint if it's a one-to-many presentation, an all hands meeting, but just for a decision-making forum, we found narratives are just, allows you to make better decisions. So that is why we switched to narratives. It was back in 2004, and it started off in Jeff Bezos's management team meetings. Teams would come in and they would present a PowerPoint to us about either a decision that they needed to make or an update on a business or, hey, should we go and acquire this company or move into a new market? Issues are getting more and more complicated. The stakes are getting higher and higher. And we realized we weren't getting through these presentations. People, were jumping around, asking questions. The presentation would never get finished. And we had been studying different ways on how to improve decision making. And, kudos to Edward Tufte was one of the things we had read some of his books and essays, and he actually came in and spoke, inspired us. And Jeff, one day after a particularly painful S team, that's his management team meeting, there were 4 hours every Tuesday. On Wednesday, he said, okay, we're going to switch to narratives. A couple of things that was notable about this, he said, there's no more PowerPoint. You need to come in with a written narrative. One, it was an experiment. We didn't know whether it would work or not. If it didn't work, it was reversible. So we could have gone back to using slides like every other company was using for those types of forums. The second thing that we wanted to try to do, the first narratives were not very good, to be honest. It takes a couple of iterations to get your narrative stride. But the reason we switched, Jeff later called this move one of the best decisions Amazon had ever made, was several reasons. One is that it really forces the writer or writing team, because they're often not written just by a single individual, to have clarity of thought. It's easy to throw a bunch of slides together and get up and talk about a topic. It doesn't take that much time to do, quite honestly. But to write a well-structured six-page narrative where the clarity of thought shines through from the first page to the last is hard. It takes more than one night. You can't write a narrative the night before. It's incumbent upon the writing team to really get their story straight before they're coming to another group and asking for feedback or help. The second thing is just pure information density. You know, you got about 7 to 9 times pixel density on a written document versus big bulleted point slides. And people also read faster than they talk, so you can get through a lot more information. And you can cover multi-causal arguments a lot faster, and I mean, a lot better in narratives versus slides, the hierarchical slide and then next slide, next slide. And everyone reads the whole document before they comment on it too. So all in, you get about 20 times, you know, but anywhere between 10 to 20 times as much information flowing from the presenting team to the audience. And you're going to make better decisions if you have more information. And it's the same unit of time. You know, an hour of listening to and asking and during a slide presentation is the same as an hour of, you know, reading, where the way that Amazon meetings work is the first 20 minutes you read the narrative, and there's a massive amount of information being transferred from the writing team to the audience. Then you have 40 minutes of high quality discussion, debate, and, you know, decision making based on that information. It's still the same hour. You just get 20 times as much information. So you'll leave that meeting with a better decision more often than not, as if you use a tool where you get, you know, 20 times less information. So that's why Amazon did it, and why we found that they work better.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. And I 100% agree with the notion of forcing you to write something like this is going to force clarity of thought, and it will be obvious if you wrote it the night before. So 100% agree with those concepts. It sounds like this is a tool that you can use for decision making, and it's particularly great for decision making. So one of the things that was ambiguous for me is, when do you use the 6-page narrative process in general? And like, what kind of meetings are they used for? Are they used for, you know, recurring sort of staff or weekly business review meetings? Or are they used for only meetings where the purpose is to get to a decision?
Yeah. So things like your annual plans, definitely use narratives for that. Quarterly business reviews, where you're recapping progress. What are the, you know, what went well, what didn't, you know, what are we going to do next? Where are the obstacles we need help on removing? Monthly business reviews. If it's a weekly business review or a data deck, that's not a narrative. That's typically a well-structured set of data that you look through. There's a specific type of narrative called a PRFAQ that Amazon uses. So it stands for press release and frequently asked questions. Amazon uses narratives to take an idea, to vet it, to decide whether they want to greenlight it, to turn it into a product or service. So that is what it is. And also, if you have any new idea, or if you're trying to present something, rather than just talk about it at a meeting and say, let's get everyone together, typically what happens is you'll be asked to write a document. It could either just be a six pages or less than an hour. So you don't, it doesn't have to be 6 pages. Or if it's an idea you want to turn into a product, it's a very specialized form of narrative called a PRFAQ document. You'll get asked to write that first before you get a group of people together to decide what to do next. And then the cases where it's not used, weekly business review, where you're looking at lots of data, well-structured data, you know, all hands meetings or things like that. You don't pass out narratives to everyone and have them comment online.
Yeah. So it's not like, I mean, just a day in the life of Colin, the leader, how often would you end up writing one of these narratives?
I would review more narratives when I was working with Jeff, and then when I went into other parts of the organization afterwards and in other companies, I would read and comment on two to three narratives a day. Sometimes with working with Jeff Bezos when I was his chief of staff, it was more than that. You know, we would go from one meeting to the next, you know, 60-ish minutes. We'd read a narrative, you know, comment on it, have a discussion, go on a completely different topic. That was really the primary way of, getting information over to Jeff in a really very efficient manner, so he could give high quality feedback and detailed feedback on the issue at hand. So, senior leaders at Amazon, several a day, they would read. In terms of writing them, again, you can't write them overnight. So you can't, if you did it every day, you'd have to have a long pipeline of working on it. You know, I would write narratives, still do write narratives occasionally. We wrote a narrative when we were, before we were starting the book, we wrote a PR FAQ document about working backwards to see if there's anything there.
So that's interesting. So if you have, say, a, you know, recurring monthly business update, something like that, that's where you would use this sort of narrative format. Like that would be a prime case of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be a prime case. Or you go in and a team has an update on, or I mean, has a new idea that they want, or, you know, feature that they want to propose. It could be the search team's got a new idea on something, and they would, you read in a narrative about that. Even redesigns, by the way, that are largely UI driven, the first part would be a narrative, and then you could look at mockups, but the narrative really helps set the stage on what is it we are really trying to accomplish? What are the, you know, what are the goals? Why are we doing this? What does success look like? Then you can look at those mockups and give high quality feedback. Whereas if you just say, hey, we're redesigning this, let's go look at mockups. Everyone has a slightly different set of first principles on what it looks like, and everyone's an expert on UI, so they'll give different feedback that's not entirely helpful for the team moving forward. So narratives, even in that case, can really help set the stage.
So you mentioned a few cases where narrative can be useful. Do you then have templates, or are there must be example ones that circulate in the company where it's like, oh, proposing a new idea or a redesign, and you can basically use the same format?
Yeah. So that once you start, and this is why it took Amazon a little, and I'm talking really a matter of weeks or months. So it's not any organization can start writing narratives tomorrow. It's an easy change to make. And it takes a little bit, but not that long to get good at it. And really what happens is narratives that are, examples of shining clarity of thought get passed around the company, even though it's a different, completely different area of business. You'll see, oh, this is what good looks like. This is the information density that I need. This is the story arc. Like for instance, flowery language is discouraged in narratives because it's more about uncovering truth than it is about trying to sell your idea. And so you can see when some documents that didn't go too well, those get circulated too, by the way. But so you don't really have to have templates because you actually have the actual narratives, that, hey, this is a great one. I heard this went well. Can I read this? Or, you go find it. So that is one of the nice things about narratives is you know where the bar is relatively quickly in terms of what makes a great narrative.
I wanted to spend some time talking about the weekly business review. I'm just curious, on an ongoing basis, it sounds like, at a very senior level, there were many business updates. So maybe that was a recurring meeting that you might have had with different groups. There's a weekly business review at the executive or the S team level. I assume you had some one-on-one meetings with, individuals that reported directly to you. What other types of meetings would you have normally had that were, say, I guess just recurring in nature?
In terms of a leader, how you spend your time is probably one of the most important decisions you can make. And so, step back and think about, what percentage of the time do I want to devote to these different issues? So first of all, I think one-on-ones with your directs are incredibly important. So I try to schedule those and then schedule things around that. I found it particularly frustrating. I did have some managers where the one thing I would know is my one-on-one would get moved three or four times if I had it, before it came up in the week. So I try not to do that. I try to get predictability for my direct reports because, again, my goal as a manager is to help them be successful. It's hard to do that when they don't know when they can ask questions or they don't know when they're going to meet with me next. So I think having one-on-ones is incredibly important. To stay connected to the details of your own organization or what's going on with your business is incredibly important too. I've seen some at other companies, managers or leaders think, well, as my role increases in scope at the company, I can get more and more removed from the details of the business. So at Amazon, we rejected that approach and we said, for that same investment of time, how can we stay connected at a deep level to a wider variety of activities that are happening? And so, you know, with something like a weekly business review is incredibly important to look at all of the details of the business to know, what did my customers experience last week? Are we on track meeting, you know, to our plans, and are we trending to get better? You as a manager need to know that, know those details, and you need to figure out a way to get that information. You know, you have it, for instance, when you're a sole proprietor, you're running a store or a coffee shop, you can see how long the lines are. You can see if people like the coffee. You know, when people look in and if the line's too long, they walk away. You know, if your vendors are late and you don't have all the product you need to sell, the impact of that. Once you get more and more proxy layers between you and your customer, metrics are the way that you remove those proxies. You have to have the right types of metrics, what you call customer-facing controllable input metrics, to know, what did my customers experience last week? So to try to figure out how to get that information is incredibly important. So there's the one-on-ones, staying connected with your business. And then another principle to keep in mind is, I tend to focus on what are the biggest opportunities for my group, not necessarily what's the biggest business or what is the most pressing problem. And you know, to give an example, when I was working with Jeff Bezos in the mid 2000s as his chief of staff, you know, if you look at Jeff's calendar, then you know, multi-billion-dollar business, but probably, I don't know, about half of his time was focused on figuring out if there's anything to this web services thing, which would eventually become AWS, figuring out how to make the digital transition. Those two businesses combined had a revenue of roughly zero, but he was spending half of his time on that to try, because he knew those were two big opportunities for the company. He had capable leaders in, you know, Jeff Wilkie and the fulfillment and side of the business, and then, you know, Diego Piacentini on the retail side. So he could have the bandwidth to focus on those details. So that's the other thing I would advise, is to know what your big opportunities are and where you want to make your personal mark, and figure out how you can organize some of your time to focus on that.
Yeah, that's incredible advice. To dig in on one of the things that you said about the weekly business review, I had a tactical question about this, and you kind of reference it in the book as well. But if you're looking at a bunch of metrics and, you know, say that people say that, well, we have a live dashboard and, you know, anybody can, we have a screen in the office and you can just look at it, or I have a tab open in my browser and I can just see all the dashboards live. What is then the point of the weekly business review, or what happens that still makes that a useful get together?
Yeah. So dashboards can be useful, but I think what really the power of the weekly business review is, it's an end-to-end consistent look at the activities of your company or your organization. You know, it's a nice fractal quality, so it doesn't have to be for the whole company, but it can be for my individual group. Who are my customers? They, by the way, could be internal customers or external customers. What did they experience? Because you know, a single metric doesn't tell the whole story. And often you need a group of metrics to really paint a picture of what happened. And when you look at an end-to-end view, you see how different activities are, you know, impact one another. You know, if something, so for instance, if you see customer service contacts go up, it could be because you had some late vendor deliveries, or, you know, there's a website outage. You get to see the linkage between those different activities on and how they impact one another. And when you review it as yourself or as a management team, everyone gets that global view. And so you can optimize globally versus focusing on, you know, what is my area. The other thing is, you don't really just want to look at vanity metrics. So, you know, that consistent thing means sometimes you don't spend any time, everything's normal, so you just skip right over that. But, you know, every once in a while, there will be a blip where you need to pay attention to. So instrumented right, it's a very quick and efficient way to get a holistic view, again, of what did my customers experience last week? Did we meet expectations, and are we hitting plan, and are we getting better, and are we on track of where we need to, you know, on track to where we need to be? And that's hard with the dashboard. Dashboards are really point in time, or, you know, they may have some graph, but it's it changes, and it's just one metric.
Yeah. And that's interesting. And the other thing that stood out to me was you were saying that you don't come into the meeting and view the data for the first time. If you're an owner of a series of metrics, like if there is a blip, you will have spent some time and have some things to talk about. So are you then ever problem solving during this meeting, or you identify issues and if they need to be solved, you know, people look into it and then bring it back to the next iteration of that meeting?
Ideally, the teams or the people who own the metrics have spotted that and they come to the meeting. Hopefully they've detected it and either have a plan of action or solved it. And if not, then, you know, this is not a, okay, let's figure out how to solve it. That you do assign action items or issues after that. So, and you don't get caught up in the strategy about, are we doing the right thing? You know, the weekly business review is really a tactical view on the business, but there are action items that do come out of that. And then you can you report on those later, either at the beginning or the end or offline through, you know, some other Slack channel or email, what have you.
One of the other things that I was going to ask you about is just communication. At such a large organization, were there a series of practices, you know, to just basically keep everybody informed on, you know, what the mission is, what the vision is, what things are being worked on? I know you had this annual planning process with OP1 and OP2, and that brings a lot of alignment, I guess, in the beginning, but obviously business is very dynamic and things start to change. I'm curious, like, how did you continue to keep everybody steering in the same direction and also be aware of the things that are going on?
So in terms of everyone in the direction, so I'll just talk about the retail business at Amazon. There are a bunch of other ones, but there's the concept of the flywheel, you know, tip of the hat to Jim Collins and his book, Good to Great, where he introduces that. But Amazon has a flywheel that's all about what are the customer experience vectors that I need to work on. And if I do these things over the long run, it's going to yield the right output metrics for the business. You know, so in terms of price, selection, convenience, and there's a whole lot of sub metrics and activities there. Everyone in the retail business knows that flywheel. It's simple to understand. You also know what I'm working on. Is it spinning this flywheel faster or is it doing something else? And if it's doing something else, you question whether that activity in itself is worth doing. So that alignment is really, really powerful. And you don't then have to litigate, well, if you know what the flywheel is, which are your durable customer needs that you're trying to improve over time. You know, if I improve it today, it's going to pay dividends, you know, tomorrow, next year, 10 years down the road. You don't have to litigate whether it's worth lowering your cost structure or not. You know, that's good and virtuous in and of itself. So then you're really just sequencing. You're not trying to pick from a series of activities and trying to evaluate whether they're good or not. So I would encourage trying to figure out what your flywheel is for the organization and then making sure everyone understands that. That is a powerful alignment tool in and of itself. You're right that the annual plans, they start to go stale the day after they're written and approved because things move fast, things are changing. You know, to really stay updated on what's going on, just being immersed in the metrics. And this isn't only the weekly business review, but just knowing what's going on, knowing when things aren't normal. The only way to know that is to know what normal looks like. And so you have to look at data, you know, dashboards, weekly, daily email flashes or whatever, so you know what normal looks like, so you can detect when something needs to be acted on. And then the last thing is really with the leadership principles, you don't want people to memorize them. I suspect that there are not that many people at Amazon who could verbatim recite all 14 leadership principles and all, you know, three or four sentences of with them behind each of them without making a slip up. But they deeply understand them because they're embedded in every process the company does. It's hard to go through a day or a week at Amazon without encountering several of these leadership principles directly in terms of when you're presenting a plan, you're looking at metrics, you're figuring out what to do next. You know, so those leadership principles have to shine through and they have to have teeth, we call them. They have to be actionable.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, obviously, everybody should go out and get the book. There's a lot of details. There's a lot of stories. stories. And it's really this inside look. And, you know, I wanted to start by saying thank you to both you and Bill for producing this work. Sharing the advancements in management science has been great, and so many people can learn from it. But one of the questions that we like to ask everybody, you know, for all the managers and leaders constantly looking to get better at their craft of managing and leading teams, are there any, you know, tips or tricks or final words of wisdom that you'd like to leave them with?
Sure. I've had some great mentors in my career, you know, and just even when I started out in school and started out my job, different people. So, you know, I think having mentors, whether they work at your company or not, that, you know, that doesn't matter, really helps, because having a sounding board, sometimes being a leader can be a little lonely at times where, so having someone who you can trust and rely on. The other thing, and this is one thing Jeff Bezos told me, is that seek out leaders who are like you, effective leaders who are like you personality wise, and then you can try to emulate those people. Don't try to emulate a great leader who's not like you, because it will come across as fake or not genuine, and it won't actually be as effective. And you can't become someone who you aren't. So, you know, try to seek out leaders who have some similar traits as you, and find out what makes them great leaders, and then try to incorporate some of that behavior into your own leadership style. Because there are plenty of different leadership styles that work, and you need to figure out what is the right leadership style for you.
That's incredible advice, and a great place to end it. Colin, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you. And this is a great question. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.